This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. And as we've been hearing, town meeting results are in, and VPR has been busy the last few days compiling what communities across the state have decided on their town and school budgets, their local officials, and other big decisions, like whether Vermont should create a state bank, or whether local communities agree with the path of a proposed natural gas pipeline. Here to talk about it all is VPR's news director, John Dillon. Hi, John.
Hello, Nina.
So voters rejected 34 school budgets, including those in the state's biggest communities like Burlington, Bennington, St. Johnsbury, Montpelier. So what happened with school budgets this year?
Well, this is the biggest, largest number of budgets that went down since 2003. And I think there's a bit of a mixed message. VPR's Bob Kindle just got off the phone with Steve Dale, who is runs the Vermont School Boards Association. And he says that in about half these cases, he feels that voters rejected these budgets because spending itself was just too high. He's not calling it a taxpayer rebellion, that, you know, the budgets were just out of scale for what the voters wanted to approve. The other half, he feels, came from this disconnect between budget increases and much higher property school property tax increases. And he feels, and we heard this out in the field yesterday, that the voters are frustrated by a funding system that's led to tax increases that are just out of scale to the proposed budgets. And an example, in Westford, a school budget increase of just 2.3% yielded a tax rate increase of 11%. So there's a disconnect there that voters were reacting to. But in Montpelier, where the budget has usually been supported, school board chair Sue Aldrich said there is an organized campaign to vote down the budget there.
There's a group in Montpelier that have been wanting to, you know, have school budgets fail for a long time because they think our budgets are excessive. And they were extremely well organized this year.
So, John, does that mean an organized campaign may force lawmakers to revisit the school funding formula?
We'll see. I mean, there's some movement in the State House to look at this, to revise the formula, but there's probably 2 months left in the session. I don't think there's going to be any major landmark changes to Act 60 and Act 68, our two funding laws. We'll see some small tweaks probably around the edge of the financing system. And as you know, the education committees are looking at incentives to force or to encourage, rather, schools to merge, school districts to merge. But that's not going to yield any significant savings for a number of years.
On another issue, John, about 20 towns voted on a resolution that would have the state create a public bank. Unofficial results say that 15 of those towns passed that non-binding resolution. What are the chances that lawmakers will take a look at that idea?
Well, they'll take a look at it, but I think the chances of a public bank created by the state of Vermont are probably slim to none. State Senator Anthony Polina from Washington County has been pushing it, as has other progressives, but State Treasurer Beth Pierce, who has a lot of credibility in the State House and considerable influence, says this is just too risky. But she doesn't see it as an all-or-nothing proposition. What they're thinking about and what they've actually done is use state lending pools for projects like home energy efficiency, commercial energy efficiency, done through existing institutions, the Vermont Economic Development Authority. And they think they can use state funds to accomplish what the proponents of public banking want without the risk of the state actually, you know, having to be a bank.
This is not
and one hurdle in getting this through to the public is explaining, you know, what a public bank is. And in Rochester, where they voted on this, organizer Bruce Marshall was speaking about that at the town meeting.
This is not a question of retail banking. This is a question of where the state puts its deposits and what we do with those deposits and who collects interest on those deposits.
So just getting across that concept is proved a difficult one at town meeting and probably for lawmakers themselves.
I want to ask you about another big issue that came up during town meeting. Voters in Burlington have passed three new gun control measures yesterday. The legislature will have to sign off on these before they go into effect. But what would these new rules do in Burlington?
They would allow police officers to confiscate guns or weapons from suspects in domestic violence cases. They would ban firearms from locations, bars, and restaurants with liquor licenses, and then require firearms to be locked up when not in use or not with the users. The opponents say this violates a Vermont statute passed in the 1980s that's known as the Sportsman's Bill of Rights, which effectively blocks local communities from imposing restrictions on gun ownership and control. There are changes to the city charter, and charter changes must be approved by the state legislature. Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger told VPR this morning that he'll be at the State House to argue his constituents' desires to lawmakers.
Certainly, we will be working on this issue. My sense is that this issue will require some considerable debate in Montpelier. It does come into some conflict with a long-held policy in Montpelier of avoiding local regulation of gun issues. And I think it may well take some time for the legislators to sort through.
So not only does it come into conflict with Montpelier wanting to avoid gun control in general politically, but the legislative leaders are saying that in order to approve the charter change itself, they would have to revise that state law, that Sportsman's Bill of Rights. So it's not just a matter of approving these charter changes, which would be an uphill road. It's a matter of changing state law to accommodate it.
Another trend we saw in a lot of different towns across the state was a move away from elected town officers toward appointed officials. And on the surface, that seems somewhat anti-democratic. Can you explain what the reasoning is behind that?
Yes, town government, running communities with budgets is getting increasingly more complicated. So towns are deciding to take these elected officials, elected positions like lister and auditor, and make them appointed so the select board would hire an auditor or a lister. I mean, lots of times they have to get an appraiser anyway to do, work with the lister side by side and when they appraise town property. And so they want that expertise. And in Woolcott, Assistant Town Clerk Belinda Clegg was trying to explain this problem to voters there.
We've had an auditor's position open for a year and nobody's wanted to fill it. And the two auditors that were doing the accounts do not feel qualified to do it anymore. One has just resigned, and the other one was up for election today and has decided not to rerun. So it's a matter of not finding people to actually do it because they do not feel qualified to do the work like a CPA would.
And that vote in Woolcott was unanimous in favor of contracting with a professional firm to audit the books of all the town departments. Voters in Londonderry and Woolcott passed. Voters in Londonderry passed similar votes as did some other towns.
Well, a host of towns voted on issues related to energy products in their town meetings. Let's start in Addison County with those.
Well, Addison County, the big issue was the natural gas pipeline extension that Vermont Gas wants to run down through the county, eventually to Rutland, but also over to Ticonderoga, New York, for the International Paper Plant. Cornwall and Shoreham voted their opposition to that phase two. That's still up for consideration before the Vermont Public Service Board. Moncton, which is already part of phase one, and that's already been approved, voted its opposition. In fact, their language was to denounce the entire project. But none of these town votes will have much sway over Vermont Gas or the Public Service Board, but they do send a message of concern from these towns. Bruce Hyland is the chair of Cornwall Select Board.
We could resolve to do all sorts of things, but the statutes and the legislature and the procedures are all there. So this is simply our opportunity to say where we stand.
Another energy topic on many town warnings in the Northeast Kingdom yesterday was about a pipeline for tar sands oil. What was that issue about?
Well, there is an existing pipeline there that carries oil already, and the proposal or the concept would be that flow would be reversed to carry tar sands oil from Alberta to Maine. And 12 towns went on record as opposing that idea, that transportation of tar sands oil through this 60-year-old pipeline.
Well, and finally, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting in that these are towns that don't really, you know, step out in terms of activism and taking these non-binding resolutions for issues on environmental issues. So the fact that they're concerned about, you know, possible rupture of this pipeline is significant because of the nature of the communities involved.
Sure. Finally, John, there was also a vote yesterday that was in Lowell about wind energy. And what happened with that vote?
They were required. There's already a wind project in Lowell that was approved a number of years ago. But they were required by the Supreme Court to hold this vote because it was passed over improperly at a previous town meeting. It was overwhelmingly approved, supported by Lowell voters. They got a big, big tax boost from this project, and the vote was 110-27 in favor of the Lowell project. That didn't end the debate. GMP said it showed voter support renewable projects, but the opponents immediately pounced on that statement, saying, you can't call it renewable. You sell the renewable credits. You're not allowed under federal trade rules to call this renewable. So the fight continues.
All right. Listeners, VPR.net has extensive coverage of the votes for school and town budgets, also which towns passed the resolutions that we've discussed just now and which didn't. All that coverage is available at VPR.net, and we're updating it regularly. John Dillon is VPR's news director. John, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Nina.
Well, as we just mentioned, at town meetings yesterday, several communities voted to hire professionals for positions like auditor and town clerk. That may have something to do with the high level of embezzlement that we've been seeing in towns across the state. Still to come, we'll talk with experts about why so much financial fraud has been reported in Vermont and what towns and businesses can do to stop it. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack. Last summer, Karen Brisson, the former town clerk of Weybridge, was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison for stealing at least $400,000 from the town of Weybridge. Brisson had been a town clerk and treasurer there for 27 years. In 2011, Isle LaMotte former town clerk and treasurer Suzanne LaBombard admitted to skimming $100,000 from town coffers. And then there's Joyce Bellavance, who worked as an office manager at the Hardwick Electric Department. In 2012, Bellavance was sentenced to 3.5 years in federal prison for stealing $1.6 million from the small utility. Today in Vermont Edition, we're going to talk about what many are calling an epidemic of embezzlement and fraud occurring in our state and what can and is being done to stop it. My guests today are Barbara Arell. She teaches forensic accounting at the University of Vermont. That's the type of bookkeeping used to unravel fraud cases. And Assistant Attorney General John Treadwell is also with us. He's been investigating and prosecuting a number of municipal embezzlement cases. John Treadwell and Professor Arell, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good afternoon.
So I think what makes these cases really so awful is that the people doing the stealing are your friends, they're your neighbors, they're your coworkers, or they're your town clerk, and most of these people are folks that you trust. John Treadwell, does the state keep track of how much is being stolen this way every year? And if so, how much money are we talking about?
I'm not sure that there is any particular state agency that keeps those figures. I know that the state auditor's office has compiled a record of these types of embezzlements that have occurred over the past 5 to 10 years or so. I don't have the exact figures involved at hand. However, you know, there are clearly thefts or embezzlements that have occurred that have involved hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then there are a number of such offenses that have involved significantly less money as well.
And are the numbers going up every year, as I've read about? Is that accurate?
I'm not sure that that it's possible to say definitively whether or not more is being stolen. Certainly, there have been a number of recent cases where individuals have been caught having stolen significant amounts of money. That may just be because better techniques are used to detect such activity.
Well, let's take a few minutes and talk about a specific case of embezzlement, not only to give listeners an idea of how this sort of crime can happen, but how it can go on for so long before it's uncovered. Barbara Arell, I'd like you to tell us about Don Hewitt. He's the former town clerk and treasurer for the town of Ira. He took more than $400,000 of taxpayer money over about a 12-year period. And I know folks who live in Ira. It's a tiny town southwest of Rutland with a population of about 430 people. And when this came to light a few years ago, it was really devastating for that community.
Sure. Yeah, he was the town treasurer, as you mentioned, for over 30 years. And the issue is that he had a lot of trust. He had a lot of trust of the town. They allowed him to do all the bookkeeping on his own. He actually took the books home to his own house and worked out of his own house. And so with all that trust, he had a lot of opportunity. And he took advantage of the opportunity to write checks to himself and deposit those checks in his personal account. And he also took advantage of the cash payments that came in from the town residents for their property taxes. He would take the cash and then go into the books and forgive the tax payments for those taxpayers. So in effect, he was able to cover up the money that he was stealing.
Well, and I read, according to an article in the Burlington Free Press, that this was not sort of an occasional pilfering. This was a regular systematic system that he had for writing himself checks. And I think in 2005, I read that his most lucrative year, he wrote 19 checks from the town account to himself, ending with a nice Christmas bonus that his neighbors knew nothing about for about $3,300. And I guess my question, Barbara Arell, is how could there be no oversight? How was it that someone else in the town wasn't also looking at these books?
Yeah, as we mentioned, he had a lot of control, and so he was doing everything. He was writing the checks. He's the one that got the bank statements at the end of the month. He's the one that's reconciling the bank statements. Nobody else was seeing the checks. No one else was seeing how much cash was coming in and comparing it to the tax payments that should have been coming in. So the oversight is really what was lacking here, and that just somebody else needed to pay attention. Somebody else needed to look at the bank statements. Somebody else needed to see, hey, there's a check going to our town treasurer. Why is that? You know, question, you know, just somebody else to take a look.
Well, so how did he finally get caught?
I think there was a tip, actually, that helped them to discover that he was writing these checks, and then they were able to go back and just look into it and see that the bank statements actually had checks written to him, and then go into a little bit deeper of the property tax payments and to see that, you know, he was really having too much authority writing off those payments that he shouldn't have.
John Treadwell, I understand that Don Hewitt actually worked with former state auditor Tom Salmon and other state officials to develop an anti-embezzlement checklist for municipalities, nonprofits, and state government, kind of like a computer hacker might work with law enforcement on cybercrime. Has Hewitt's input been helpful? Are you familiar with what he kind of wrote up with some state officials a few years ago?
Yeah, I am familiar with internal control checklists that have been generated by the auditor's office in consultation with various people. And also the Vermont League of Cities and Towns has developed model policies and suggestions for towns to avoid such conduct occurring in the future.
Listeners, what do you think about this issue? Has your town dealt with financial fraud? Have you been the victim of embezzlement, either at the town level or maybe with your business? We'd like to hear your thoughts. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211. Again, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can go to vpr.net and click on the Vermont Edition link there and post your thoughts online. John Treadwell, what makes a town an easy target for fraud? Barbara Arell was just mentioning that, you know, the town clerk in Ira had a lot of control. He was taking records home. But, you know, it's not just happening in Ira. A lot of towns have gone through this. What are some of the easy mistakes that towns make?
Well, I think that the professor described exactly the type of situations that we've seen in other circumstances where a single person is basically given control over financial documents in the town It sounded very reminiscent of what occurred in the town of Isle of Mott, where the town clerk, town treasurer, had been in office for many years, more than 20 years, was generally trusted and was entirely in charge of initiating, recording, and reconciling transactions. She prepared the warrants to be approved by the select board. She prepared the checks. She deposited the checks. She was in charge of collecting cash. And effectively, there was no control over her that would have made it possible to determine whether money was being misappropriated. And that is exactly what occurred in that case. So avoiding those situations where a single individual has total control, unsupervised control over assets and money is a significant, important value.
Well, and as we also heard earlier on the program when I was talking with John Dillon, Londonderry and Walcott both voted during town meeting day elections to do away with their town auditor positions. Walcott's assistant town clerk, Belinda Clegg, told voters there simply wasn't anyone willing to do the job and that no one felt qualified. Barbara Orell, is part of the problem with some of these towns and with embezzlement in smaller communities that there is a lack of training, that folks whose job it may be to follow the money simply don't have the skills or training to do it thoroughly?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, we're a trusting community. We put people into positions and we trust that they're going to, you know, handle the responsibilities that we give them. But we need to have this system in place in which, you know, we're just putting a check in. We're just putting a check or a balance in. People might not know how to do it. They might be afraid because it's accounting or, you know, numbers, and they're not sure. But what they're serving is just as a check on the person and the work that that person's doing. And so it could be as simple as just having someone on the board open the bank statement. You know, just look at the bank statement. Look through the checks, look through the cash that's getting deposited. Just have a separate check and balance on that person that you're giving all that responsibility to.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about financial fraud and embezzlement and why Vermont seems to be especially prone to these kinds of crimes. My guests today are Assistant Attorney General John Treadwell and UVM Accounting Professor Barbara Orell. You can join our conversation. Has your town had to deal with this? Has your business? Is the punishment for this type of crime severe enough, or do you think prison is too harsh? 1-800-639-2211, our phone number here at Vermont Edition, if you'd like to join the conversation. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or if you're on your computer, you can head over to Vermont Edition's Facebook page and post your thoughts there. So, John Treadwell, in communities that go through this kind of thing, are taxpayers left on the hook for the lost money, or does insurance from, say, the League of Cities and Towns cover these types of losses?
I think that depends on the particular losses involved. In each case, of course, where there is a criminal prosecution, there is the possibility that restitution will be ordered. In the Isle of Mott case, for example, the town clerk repaid the amount that was allegedly stolen prior to criminal charges being filed in that case. So there was an argument made that the town was made whole in that particular case.
Huh. And how about how expanded training might be available? Barbara Orell, are there places that town, you know, officials can go to find out, to get auditing help? Or, you know, should they just hire outside auditors and make that sort of part and parcel of how they operate their town offices?
Well, it's always a good idea to have an outside audit done. You can bring in a smaller firm who might not charge as much as a larger Big Four firm. But that firm can come in and serve as that check, the control, to monitor really what's going on, and to give you some comfort that, you know, someone is looking at the book, someone's providing a check. And, you know, as far as training going, you know, there are a lot of CPE sessions that go on around the Vermont Society of Public Accountants, Certified Public Accountants. They put on sessions that address fraud or embezzlement. And they do put on a lot in general that regarding internal control. And like I said, we have at UVM, we're teaching a forensic and fraud examination course that I'm teaching next year to our Masters of Accounting students. But it's just an opportunity for someone to come in and sit in. Learning from other experiences is always helpful as well. You know, learning about these cases after they occur give you an idea of what can happen in your town. And so it takes that to you go back and look at your town, see what controls you have in place or what maybe you should do. The other site that you could look at is the state auditor's website. They do have some internal control checklists that were developed. You mentioned before, those checklists are helpful for towns. They're just simple checklists to ask questions of what's in place and what could be put in place.
Eric wrote in, it seems to me that a person could hardly embezzle hundreds of thousands of dollars without the knowledge of a spouse or other family member. Have any family members suffered consequences for being accessories to these types of crime? John Treadwell, that's an interesting question.
Yes, and I'm not actually aware of any family members who've been charged in state court related to these types of activities. The amounts involved can add up significantly over time, but each individual embezzlement can be a small quantity of cash, for example. But given that it continues over many, many years, that's where you sometimes end up with these very big totals for the amount that is missing.
But if some of these folks that are stealing have to pay restitution, I'm imagining their house might be confiscated to help pay that bill, and that would definitely affect a family member.
Absolutely.
And I haven't asked you just about prison sentences and punishment besides restitution. How are people who are caught embezzling punished besides the restitution angle? What sort of prison terms do they face, and do you think it's severe enough?
Well, embezzlement is generally treated more severely than larcenies, thefts generally, because it involves a breach of trust. There are prosecutions at the state level by both the Attorney General's office and the county state's attorneys, and at the federal level by the U.S. Attorney's office. The statute in Vermont relating to embezzlement by public employees has a maximum term for each embezzlement of 10 years in prison and a $1,000 fine, no matter how much is actually stolen. Hmm. So that's potentially a significant term of imprisonment.
Again, listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking about financial fraud and embezzlement. Maybe this is a subject that's hit home with you. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phones now and take a call from St. Albans. David's on the line. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Well, I have to chime in about the prison sentences and the amount of time and whether it's tied to the amount that's stolen over the period of time that it's stolen. I recently am a business owner. I'm a victim of an embezzler. We had somebody that was on our payroll that was working for us for about 4 years, stole hundreds of thousands of dollars. Was convicted on $50,000 because of the way that our bookkeeping reported, and was given a 2.5-year suspended sentence and was ordered to pay some restitution. During this period of time in our community, a person was convicted, caught for embezzling from a drugstore chain, a national franchise, and was given 2 years in prison, no suspended sentence, for a much less amount. And that was on the news. It was carried everywhere. And it was just amazing to me that such a person, such difference in penalties over the amounts. So, again, I that's all I wanted to say.
All right, David, thanks for that call. Let's go to Essex now and take a call with Ann. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. David already pointed out it's obviously not just a town government issue, but businesses. And I've also seen this happening in nonprofits, including churches, where my theory is that it's usually not someone setting out to be criminal, but the lack of oversight just provides opportunity and unresistible temptation. So I've seen cases where church treasurers have borrowed money, paid it back, but then been caught, and in one case lost a teaching license long before she would have wanted to retire. So I came to the conclusion quite a long time ago that those of us who pray a certain prayer that includes the line, "Lead us not into temptation," one of the answers to that is to have a good audit in place.
All right. Well, listeners, we will continue this discussion on financial fraud, embezzlement issues that are seem to be especially prevalent in Vermont when we come back. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about financial fraud and embezzlement and why Vermont seems to be especially prone to these kinds of crimes. My guests are Assistant Attorney General John Treadwell and UVM Accounting Professor Barbara Arell. Barbara Arell, I'd like to ask you, why do you think Vermont is especially prone to this type of crime? Why not New Hampshire or Maine, for instance?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have seen a lot more in Vermont than you do in New Hampshire. I think one of the reasons is because we are so trusting here in Vermont, and it's a small community. Most of our towns are small. We're electing people to the positions that we all know and we all think that we trust, and that, you know, we're electing them for a long time, and we're letting them stay in office for, you know, 20 years, 25 years, and giving them all that trust with no oversight. As someone mentioned, one of the callers, that gives them the opportunity to, you know, see where there's holes, where there's the problems, where they could, you know, if they needed extra funds, where they could take it. I think another issue is, in addition to the trust that we have, we're also a community, as some people are mentioning, that it happens in businesses as well. We have a lot of small businesses in Vermont, you know, a big entrepreneurial spirit here. Everybody wants to start their own business. Everybody wants to be the business owner, but they may not pay attention to the other side, which is the control side. You know, you have a, you know, limited number of employees. You start off small. You give them responsibilities. But at the same time that you're starting off small, you can pay attention to these controls and put in the checks and balances that you need so that as you grow, these balances are already in place, these checks are in place, and it adapts with you.
Sure. Douglas wrote in, "We have a trusting culture here in Vermont, and that is a good thing. But by choosing to close our eyes to the risks of embezzlement, by thinking that it's someone else's responsibility to be vigilant, we open our state up to big risks." Again, listeners, our phone number is 1-800-639-2211 if you'd like to weigh in on our conversation. Let's go to Jeffersonville now and talk with Doug. Hey, Doug, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I actually teach embezzlement prevention and detection, and one of the things I found is that there's not an understanding not only of what systems need to be in place, but the idea that we need to be proactive and that it really is our responsibility as individuals to be finding ways to set systems up and to keep this from happening. I've actually talked with Tom Hughes, another well-known embezzler in Vermont, who said that the lack of controls was exactly what enabled him to embezzle from his clients. He didn't have a need to, but he found out he could because no one was watching. And that's a very common theme, and something that could very easily stop a lot of embezzlement is people actually being proactive and understanding what they should be doing, their role in preventing this.
Thanks for that call, Doug. John Treadwell, I'd like to ask you, you know, law enforcement personnel often like to profile criminals, find out what they have in common, who's most likely to commit a crime. And when it comes to financial fraud and embezzlement, what sort of person are we talking about here? Are they typically first-time offenders? Are they more likely to be a woman or a man? What do you know about the type of person who is most likely to commit this type of crime?
I don't think you can draw any general conclusions about the type of person who is likely to commit such a crime. I mean, in terms of public employees who commit such crimes, clearly they are offenses that occur when people are placed in positions of trust. So we often see situations where the individuals are well-trusted in their communities. They don't generally have a significant criminal history, often, I would imagine, because that is somewhat inconsistent with being in a position of
sure.
trust. So I don't know that you can necessarily draw conclusions about the types of persons who might commit such offenses. Clearly, ensuring that there are appropriate financial controls in place so the opportunity does not exist is an important way of preventing such crimes occurring.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of callers waiting to weigh in today. Let's go to Cabot now and talk to Jessica. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, what happens is that the town people elect a town clerk and a treasurer. And what should happen is they should be two different positions, and the town treasurer should be qualified and appointed by somebody, some CPA, and the treasurer should know the double entry accrual system, for one thing. But what happens is then you have town auditors that don't find anything. So they're basically useless. Then you have the CPAs who check on all of this, outside auditors, who for years put disclaimers in the town reports that say, well, that this town bookkeeping is not complying with United States standards, but everything else is okay, which is nutty. So I myself have gone to the state auditors with a lot of evidence in hand of irregularities that I have found over the years and presented it, the whole case, out to them to look at. They looked at it, they saw it, they said, yes, 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 I see this, and they never did anything. They said it was not within their authority to check on this.
Hmm.
So there is absolutely no oversight. And if I bring this up at town meeting, I point this out, you're just shot down.
Well,
they
can
say whatever they want.
Jessica, I appreciate you calling in. Let me ask John Treadway, what should people do if they suspect someone in their community, someone they know in their business, maybe skimming some money off the top? What's step one? How do you handle that?
Well, if it's an allegation of potential criminal conduct, referral to a law enforcement agency is an appropriate way to proceed initially. Contacting a local police department, county sheriff's department, or Vermont State Police is a good place to start when making a criminal complaint of these
All right.
types.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to Middletown Springs and check in with Fred. Hi, Fred. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good afternoon. It's interesting. We had that exact issue last night where the town select board brought this before the townspeople and had a $5,000, I will say, investment towards an audit. And it was supported by the auditors, it was supported by the treasurer, it was supported by the town clerk, and the entire, we'll say the audience. So hopefully by having that at least there, it might, if there had been any issues, I think it gives some peace of mind to the townspeople that, the issue is being addressed.
All right. Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about financial fraud and embezzlement today on Vermont Edition. My guests are Assistant Attorney General John Treadwell and Accounting Professor from UVM Barbara Arell. If you have a question or a comment, you can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Woodstock now. Talk to Dot. Hi, Dot. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi, I was a victim also of embezzlement of over $200,000 in a small business, and I was embezzled by a really good friend who I trusted completely. She was the most efficient, the most professional, the best worker I ever had. If you put 100 people in the room, she'd be the last one that you'd ever suspect. And she did, systematically and calculatedly, stole over 5 years, over $200,000. And one of her methods was credit card fraud, because we had a business account. We had Home Depot accounts, and she had one also. And she was adding her phone, her cable TV, her Home Depot, everything into, and just added it on. I was looking at the end result, like the final business, of the checks. I never checked the detail of the original invoices, which everyone should do.
Oh.
You take your check and you look at the original invoice and your original credit card bills. But she was really clever. She put it into major spending accounts in my business, like fuel accounts, which I paid for her fuel.
How was she punished, Dot? How was she punished? What happened to her?
She's pleading this week, actually, in federal court, and I'm going to be very interested to see what happens in this case. Because it's not a faceless crime. You know, if somebody came in with a gun into your business and said, here, give me $200,000, you know, it's nice and clean and clear, and those people would go to jail for I don't know how many years. But this is unbelievable. It goes on. It's calculated. It's sickening.
And it's someone you know and trust.
You know, and this is a woman that's sitting next to you smiling. And you go to her kids' graduation parties, and you give her birthday presents, and you give her... It's just we're still being haunted by it.
Dot, I appreciate you calling in today, and I bet there are a lot of small business owners out there that are thinking about exactly what you've said. Barbara O'Rell, I want to ask you, you're familiar with a lot of embezzlement and fraud schemes. We just heard what Dot described happening in her business. Are there any cases of fraud that you've come across that really astounded you by either their creativity or their audacity?
Well, yeah, there was a recent one that actually came about in Illinois. It was another town treasurer who had been there for 40 years, starting shortly after she finished high school. She started to work for the town. She actually set up a secret town account, and she called it the Reserve Sewer Development Account, a nice name that people might not question, and ran all of her money through there. She wrote checks to herself. She siphoned some funds from the other accounts and put it into that account. And she used that funds to fund her prize-winning horse breeding farm business. So, you know, here's somebody who's working for the town. You might expect them to have a certain style of living. And she has this, you know, million-dollar horse breeding business. So, you know, there are signs that, you know, you question... You know, maybe lifestyle. So some people steal because, you know, they need to pay their bills and, you know, they have this need and they have an opportunity. Other people want to get ahead, you know, and they see this opportunity for them to, you know, maybe take more and they might feel a little more entitled to it, you know. And so she took it upon herself. She actually got away with $53 million from the town.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it wasn't a big town. Annual budget was only $8 million. So we're not talking a lot, but we're talking a long time, a long period of time. And, you know, she it was only found once she went on vacation. And so having somebody else do the job is another good control that, you know, we haven't actually mentioned yet. You know, somebody else step in. Somebody else look at the books. Somebody else do it.
Listeners, I think we have time for one more phone call. Let's go to Burlington and talk to Peter. Peter, I just ask you to keep it brief. We only have about a minute left.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just address, and obviously I have to do it briefly, sentencing and restitution. You just took a call from a lady in Woodstock who had a federal crime against her. I had one against me for about $250,000. I hate to be the bearer of bad news to that caller, but she will be very disappointed in the sentencing. Sentencing guidelines are set up by smart people in Washington. Charlie Tetzlaff, a former U.S. attorney to the state of Vermont, was on a committee down there for 7 years working on guidelines. And if you follow cases in the state of Vermont, you will find that very, very few embezzlements does the judge award a sentence that matches the minimum guideline.
Peter, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to jump in and just our time is brief, and I want to make sure John Treadwell has a chance to comment on your point that you need better sentencing guidelines.
Yes, I mean, there is a significant distinction between how sentencing occurs in state court and in federal court. In federal court, there are guidelines. They are no longer mandatory. But there are calculations that are done basically that gives an idea of what the sentence should be, and then a judge can depart from that. In state court, sentencing is effectively much looser. There is a maximum sentence set by statute, and then it is up to the judge, or if there is a plea agreement that is accepted, it is bargained between the parties. As to what the actual sentence is that is imposed.
All right. Barbara O'Rell is a professor of accounting at the University of Vermont. John Treadwell is assistant attorney general. I want to thank you both very much. We covered a lot of ground today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Just go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. And that's our program today. Tomorrow, we'll hear what gun owners and gun law advocates think of the vote yesterday in Burlington. Residents in the city approved three resolutions that will restrict or ban gun possession in certain instances. And you can email your questions or comments about that to vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biella directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.